listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Grassroots, listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Culture District here in sunny Fairfield, Iowa.
Sunny it is.
And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And good afternoon, everyone. And if you're listening on Monday, good morning. And good morning. Hope it's another beautiful day. And I think it's supposed to be beautiful the whole week.
Oh, boy. You know, I told somebody, I think Iowa's the winner in the climate change.
So far. So far,
yeah. Yeah. In fact, if it gets really bad, we may even have beachfront property.
Oh, dear. Oh, come on.
Okay. All right. Well, you gotta laugh. You gotta laugh.
That's true.
Else you just spend all your, just cry.
So, well, you either have to laugh or cry. That's what your dad used to say.
Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah. So, who do we have today on Writers' Voices?
Well, today we have Nancy Swisher, and she holds an MFA in Creative Nonfiction from Vermont College of Fine Arts. She was awarded the New York Individual Artist Grant for Poetry in 1983, and she has been in private practice as a coach and counselor since 1995, where she supports women to find their voice, stand behind it, and change the world. And she has written a book, and the name of that book is The Life That Woke Me Up Was My Own. Interesting title, interesting book.
Welcome to Writers' Voices, Nancy. Person.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Now, you do live here in Fairfield.
I do.
How long have you lived here?
For 6 years.
And what brought you here?
Well, I visited Art Walk August of 2008, I think. And I had been living in Iowa City for 4 years. And when I came to Fairfield Art Walk that August, I was overjoyed with the feeling of being here and thought, oh, I think I need to move there.
Wow.
And because my business is online, it's virtual, I'm not tied to any one place. So mm-hmm. It took another year to get ready to move down. But yeah, ooh. I moved in 2010.
Wow.
Have been here ever since.
So you're a coach and a counselor online?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Marketing on the internet.
But how do you deliver the services?
Oh, Skype.
Ah,
Skype.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you, with video, Skype video?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Isn't that amazing?
I'm on Skype.
That you can do that?
You know, I was on Skype this morning. I'll be on Skype again after this.
Well,
amazing.
You know, they're even doing physical medicine that way to some extent now. You know, telemedicine, they're calling it.
Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. To give access, you know, to people who might not otherwise have it.
Right.
Yeah.
I find that it's really just as powerful as in-person work.
Really?
I did in-person work for a long time. And when I moved to Iowa, I became virtual.
You know, it's interesting that, though, a lot of, I mean, I use Skype a lot in business. And in fact, we have a whole video conference room and big screen and everything. But even so, for me, it's not quite. But now this is group meetings. But it's not quite as effective as in-person meetings. But you find that it is.
For one-to-one work.
Yeah.
And I just did a live workshop in London, and it was wonderful. And I love doing the live work with groups especially. But
good.
I find with one-to-one, it's much different.
Yeah. So, okay. How did you come to write this book? And this is a memoir.
It is a memoir.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a writer. I'd been writing all my life, pretty much, which the book talks about, in a way, the power of language in my life. At one point in my late 40s, I started to realize that the way my life had unfolded resembled sort of what is known as a heroine's journey or, you know, a transformational journey, and that everything I'd experienced had a specific purpose in terms of the transformation of who I am. And so when I realized that, I had been writing, but I didn't write, you know, I wasn't writing a specific book. Then I realized, I think there's a book here. And so I began to work on it. And that was 2002, so a long time ago.
And why did it take this long, do you think, to finish?
Well, because, yeah, okay, how long do we have? Well, you know,
yeah.
I'm part turtle, that's how I joke about it, but it took a long time. It was written in lots of different stages. The story parts were written 2002, 2003, 2004, when I was in the MFA program. The present-day narrative voice didn't really get created till I moved to Iowa. So thank you, Iowa. yeah. So that voice, I had to change, you see. I had to grow into how I'm going to tell the story.
And I know that it's part of the story, part of the book, kind of this next question that I'm going to ask. So if you don't want to, a little spoiler alert, and if you don't want to answer it completely, that's fine. But, you had so much success with your writing early on, and yet you did not follow through with publishing until now. Why was that?
Why was that? That's the story of the book.
I know.
So when I was quite young, sixth grade, I had success, quote, success in the external world, won an essay contest. I also had trauma associated with that success. Mm-hmm. So in my brain, it became very associated that that being in the world, being seen in the world, being successful in the world is linked to trauma. Mm-hmm. Now, that was all unconscious.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Nancy didn't know that. I didn't know that until I was in my 40s. That's when I started putting the pieces together. Yeah. So, that's how life is, right?
It's not unusual for that to happen to people, is it?
No. Everybody has some kind of trauma. Everybody has some kind of wounding. I mean, that's mm-hmm. part of planet Earth, I think. Mm-hmm. And for me, it was around language, and it was around success.
Mm.
So, but here I am.
Yeah.
Here you are.
Did that answer your question?
It did,
okay,
yes.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So you were in this MFA program uh-huh. at Vermont College.
Uh-huh.
Now is that a low residency
it
program?
Is.
So tell us a little bit about that and how that worked for you.
It's a great program. Well, I was living in Western Massachusetts at the time, so I could just drive up for the residencies to Montpelier, and they had one of the genres you could major in was creative nonfiction. So when I studied writing earlier in the 80s, that genre wasn't taught yet mm-hmm. as a genre. It was fairly new in mm-hmm. writing programs. So I was very excited because I thought, oh my God, I finally know what genre I'm in. And so it was great. It was perfect for me because you could pick your teacher, then you worked with that teacher for 6 months. You sent writing, they sent back feedback. Mm-hmm. So many of the story chapters in this book, some of the chapters are more like narratives, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Stories. Those, almost all those were written in the MFA program. So they had lots of feedback, And so that, I was in that. I took a semester off, but basically, that was very supportive for the book. And as with anything, I think when people teach you how to do something that's creative, there's a little bit of unlearning you have to do also afterwards to really mm-hmm. get back to another voice. And so the voice that, I had to sell my house and move to Iowa to find this new voice.
And why Iowa?
Well, oh no, you didn't ask me that, did you? Well, I didn't know where to move, so I got a little consultation about it, okay, from an astrocartographer. And he said Santa Rosa or Iowa City, and I certainly wasn't ready for California, being a very, solitary, rural person. Mm. So I thought Iowa, and I checked it out, and really loved it.
Were you familiar with the like the writing community here in Iowa City?
Yes, of course. Yeah. I knew the guy who is head of the creative nonfiction there.
Wow.
But other than him, I didn't know anybody in the whole state.
Whoa.
So it was just me and my dog.
But you had one contact. That was more than some people have.
Yeah.
I've never done that, like just picked up and moved somewhere on my own, not knowing anyone. You have. Well, I mean,
never
you brought,
on my own.
Not on your own, but yeah. with the family.
Oh, yeah.
Several times,
several
right?
Several times, yep.
And I've always thought of it as something that would be such an adventure to do. But then part of me is like, but I have such a good life. Why would I want to do that?
Yeah, it's a struggle. It's a struggle sometimes.
Yeah, it is hard. But, you know, the whole reason I moved was for the book. I knew that, you know, I just had a feeling that I was done where I had been living. Everything was complete. You know, it wasn't that it was bad.
Right.
It was, in fact, it's a beautiful place. But it was for the book. I knew I needed to do it for the book.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
And the book is The Life That Woke Me Up Was My Own, a memoir by Nancy Swisher. Nancy, why don't you read a little bit from the book for
okay.
us? And I'll hold on to the mic, make sure it doesn't tip over.
We need a different mic there, I think.
Well, I need one that...
Was I not speaking loud enough?
You were. Well, the mic wasn't close enough. So
okay.
That's why.
So I'm going to read this little piece called I Already Am Who I Want to Be. And this is kind of a touchstone of the book because when I was quite young, I was very clear that I was a spiritual being and I was full of myself, so to speak. And then that connection is what got severed a bit. And then the book tells the story of becoming reconnected. So this is when I was 5 years old. When I was 5 years old, the milkman at my father's store asked me a very important question, which I didn't realize at the time was a very important question. It was a Saturday morning. The very bright summer sun had just come over our mountain. I was playing hopscotch on the sidewalk in front of our store next to our house. In 1956, hardly any traffic passed on the road in front of the store. In fact, most of the time it was so quiet that I could hear the creek across the road, the slightest breeze, the crows, woodpeckers, and sparrows. I loved this kind of silence. The milkman drove to our small grocery store in New Creek, West Virginia, from Cumberland, Maryland. We were just 5 miles from the state border. He was the tallest of all the delivery men. On this morning, as usual, he stacked the milk cartons onto the dolly to wheel them inside. But just before he opened the door of the store, he paused, looked down at me, and asked, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" I raised my hand to shade my eyes as I peered up at the tall man. Without an ounce of hesitation, I said, "I already am who I want to be."
Good answer.
I don't remember what happened next. I could speculate, which I will do. The milkman may have told my father what I said. I may have gone into the store for a popsicle and overheard them laughing. But what I do know is that the milkman ignored my answer. There was just one question, one answer, and no follow-up, which of course is just the way it was. However, because there was no follow-up, I noticed something quite new beginning to occur. A little void took root, a little cave, where my words inhaled, withdrew, and learned to love the darkness more than the light. When I said I already am who I want to be, I had spoken what I would call much later in my life, my soul words, words that come straight from my heart, where our deepest truth lives. I knew I was spirit. I knew I was a being of consciousness, but I needed someone else to know this with me. When there was no follow-up, given I was only 5, my human self quickly made a decision. Was I wrong for saying what I said? Is that why the milkman said nothing? Was that a crazy comment? And so a thought passed across my brain, perhaps not fully conscious, but there nonetheless. As time passed, as more and more of my soul words garnered no response, the thought about being crazy repeated itself. It must be so, I thought. Why else would people act as if I had not spoken? My past began to take root with this false self-concept. I say false because I was not crazy or wrong. Yet in that void of silence, my human self began to doubt.
Nancy Swisher reading from The Life That Woke Me Up Was My Own. Nancy, when you mention in this passage that you started to question whether you were crazy, and then you had a sister who sort of encouraged that thought. is that a gentle way to say it? And I'm curious because you talk about her as when you were children. She was an older sister.
Mm-hmm.
How much older?
4 years.
But you don't talk about her in your adult life at all.
Huh.
Did you retain a relationship with the sister? Were you able to heal that relationship at some point?
You know, we're just very different. We connect sometimes, but it's like we're from different
planets.
Yeah. My life has been about, inquiry and healing and transformation and all that stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like I'm sure a lot of people listening,
yeah,
their lives are too. And, she just walked a different path, a much different path. But she has read the book and she liked it.
Really?
So, yeah.
I was curious about that too.
And that was a big deal.
Were you nervous about her reading it?
Well, I think I'm very forgiving of everything because I was not going to write a book that was about
being bitter
or blaming people or anything, because I truly do believe our life unfolds exactly as it is supposed to. I do, even though sometimes it's hard to see that. My stance has always been to Hafiz, the Sufi poet, has a statement, the place you are right now, God circled on a map for you.
Mm.
And that's in the book somewhere. And that's what I believe. So, yeah, I had to get to that place to get the narrative voice, though. I didn't want to write from a stance of blame, that we don't need more blame in the world.
Now, in part of the book, too, has to deal with a kind of a recovered memory.
Uh-huh.
And did you know, had you fully recovered that by the time you started writing?
Oh, yeah. 10 years before.
Okay.
And I studied traumatic memory for 5 years. And actually, when I first began my counseling practice, I worked with people who had some history of, well, many of them did, of trauma. It's not my specialty now, you can only do that for so long, but and what's interesting about that is many times we also forget the really amazing memories. People forget, like, the passage I just read about being really connected to my essence, my spiritual self. Sometimes people forget that. And most people have that kind of experience as children.
Mm-hmm.
Did you, like this particular incident, was that something that you always remembered?
No.
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 So that was recovered too.
Well, in a way. I mean, I remembered that as I started writing.
Really? Because
writing is an incredible way to
bring back memories.
Right?
Oh, my.
Yeah.
You've experienced that, haven't
yes.
you?
Oh, have yes. You? Yeah. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Started writing. So I started a writing group at church, and you hear somebody else's experience, things. Oh yeah, something like that happened to me when I was a kid. And then there you go.
Yeah.
So Nancy, tell us a little bit about yeah, we have plenty. We have 10 minutes.
So, okay.
Yeah, so we've got plenty of time. A little bit about the writing process for you. You said, like you said, a good part of this book was written while you were in an MFA program, so that probably gave some structure to the process.
Yeah, it did. Well, it gave structure to. It did. Yeah.
And was that something that helped you, do you think, having that structure?
Well, yes, it did. Because I had never studied writing really in a university level, you know, this kind of writing.
And, right.
But I knew I was a writer. I didn't need that to really, you know, I'd already won the New York grant and published some stuff, you know, small pieces. But when I write, I really write from voice. From the voice. I listen really deeply, and sometimes I just start writing and the voice will come, and sometimes the voice isn't there at all, so I get really angry. No, I'm just kidding.
Frustrated.
And right now I'm kind of between voices, because this is over. This book is done. It's been done for a while.
Yeah.
And when I was traveling recently, I just, you know, I know there's another voice. And I've been writing a little bit, but it's just not, you know. So my process is really about, you know, it's probably just extremely right-brained, but that's how I write. I listen. And then I just get it on the page. And I write on the computer.
And you've used journaling a lot. Too as a is
well
that
journaling
a tool
is
or,
journaling is a whole is different that for me that's just a way to kind of navigate my daily life and you know
so you don't think of that as part of your literary pursuits
no
well not. you're capturing your thoughts so you can remember them I mean our brain can't remember everything
well but when I journal it's mostly like if I turn right now, I'm just focused on my business a lot, but you know, I will do dialoguing with God in my journal. Mm-hmm. I do that a lot and, or whatever God is for you, you know, I don't mind the word God and, I do that or I might, you know, just write little snippets of things. But when I'm starting something new, like another book or something, there is a voice that will come that, I know that's the voice of the book. Mm. And that's what I mean. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah. Before we run out of time, let's talk about your upcoming reading.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
So you'll be at Revelations.
Yes.
On November
19th.
And that is a Saturday.
Saturday.
And what time?
2:00 p.m.
Two in the afternoon. And so you'll be reading and signing books?
Yeah, and talking and answering questions. And I might even encourage people to do a little writing.
Oh, awesome.
Oh, good.
Now, one of the parts in your book that I really liked was when you talked about teaching writing and right out of college. And this really goes to what you're talking about, that you write from voice. And when you are in a situation where you felt like you had to squash people's voice in order to do your job.
Right.
And tell us a little bit about that.
So my first teaching job out of college, when I got the first degree in English, was at a historically black college in South Carolina called Voorhees College. And at the time, it was probably the poorest college in the country in terms of funding and the students, they were all on Pell Grants. And so that was my first teaching job. And I absolutely loved it. But like you pointed to, Monica, my job was to teach white standard English, of course.
Right.
Because they had to pass standardized tests. But my students, and I became very close with them, their actual voice was dialect, you know. It was African-American Southern dialect. And it just felt to me like, and I was young, you know, I didn't quite know why it was feeling this way, but it did. It felt like for me to teach them white standard English was somehow taking away their own voice, and it was just really painful for me. And
yeah, I can understand that.
You know,
would
and
it
I'd,
be different for you today if you were to do that today?
Oh, I think so. I think yeah. everything would be different, but
well, yeah, probably.
You know, because I was not, like I say in the book, I wasn't fully conscious for me why it seemed that way.
Right.
So now I think I would be able to even teach them to distinguish the difference, right?
Right. But here's what you have to learn, but don't lose this.
Yeah, and I'm sure I said that when I was there, but it was a really interesting little chapter in my life. And
you know, Nancy, one thing I find interesting is, you know, you grew up in the South.
West Virginia, which
is...
became part of the North during the Civil War.
Oh, okay.
Yes, we need to remember that.
Okay. Yes, we do.
But for most people, we still think of that as
right.
South.
Right.
And when you were reading from your book is when you sounded the most Southern. When
really?
Yes. When you were reading that that
just
portion.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because that was in West Virginia.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah.
It was.
Okay, all right.
I've got something I want to share with her as my ending, if that's all right.
Sure.
Okay, I use this. I always tell my children, my grandchildren this. In the journey of life, God has a plan for you. In the troubles of life, He has promised to help you. In all of life, He has a love for you which is beyond all human understanding. Does that make sense?
Oh, that's beautiful. I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
Yeah. Totally. I'm hoping that comes through in the book.
Yeah, this is a most interesting book, and I hope people will come and meet you because, and about this picture on the, did you draw that? Did you paint
that's
that?
That's one of my paintings, yeah.
I thought
also,
so.
You're a
yeah.
painter also.
Yeah.
But I didn't paint till I moved to Fairfield.
Really?
Thank you, Fairfield.
Wow.
Yep. Fairfield is an amazing place.
So just in the couple minutes we have left, how did you publish?
I published through a publisher called Thomas Noble Books with Lynn Klippel. She has a business mainly for business books, like, your typical business book.
Mm-hmm.
But this obviously is not a typical business book. It's a literary memoir. So I published through her. It is independently published. I made that choice because I didn't want to wait a year or two to do the other way. So
right.
I figure...
And it's available here in town at Revelations.
It's available at Revelations and on Amazon.
Okay.
And the Kindle edition's coming out soon, but I've hesitated on that because I prefer real books.
Mm.
Yes.
And is this your first reading that you're doing at Revelations?
No, I just did 3 readings in England.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
My goodness.
And how did it go?
They were great.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
wonderful. So you're going to do the get out there and market the book?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Committed to the book.
Very good.
That is November 19th.
November 19th at Revelations, 2 p.m. And The Life That Woke Me Up Was My Own, a memoir. What can you do when you can't speak your truth? All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us today.
It was
Nancy.
A pleasure.
Thank
really
you
was.
Both. It was really nice.
And we now have our next guest. Come on up. Listening to KRUULP 100.1, and this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and we're back. And who are we with now, Mom?
Today we're with Jim Brooks, MD, and he has spent his life helping people create health for themselves through natural medicine. He is a practicing psychiatrist who has studied and applied Maharishi Ayurvedic for many years. He received extensive training from some of the most renowned Ayurvedic physicians in India. He is the founding medical director of the Maharishi Ayurvedic Health Centers in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. He is also a teacher of the Transcendental Meditation Technique and has authored many journal articles and book chapters on Ayurvedic and mental health. And I'm assuming he's here for this particular thing that they're having now, this
So the title
conference.
Of this book is Reflections on Maharishi Ayurveda and Mental Health, and you're giving a talk
Yes,
soon?
On Sunday night.
Sunday, so
the
if you're
13th.
Listening on Friday, then this is November 11th, so and Sunday, 8 p.m. At
Dalby Hall Dalby on Hall. Campus. It's at 8 o'clock.
And is it open to the public?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And what is the topic of your talk?
The topic, I'm actually sharing that particular talk with Dr. Robert Schneider, and I think we named it Mind Over Age.
Ah.
Because the talk, the first part of the talk, Dr. Schneider will give about methods to prevent the aging process.
Mm.
And then we've figured out a way to tie that into mental health because there's so much research going on now that ideal mental, you know, that really good health, healthy mind, healthy emotions is correlated with longevity.
Mm.
So that's kind of how we put the two together, even though on the surface they're very different topics.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, you know, there were studies, I remember the Nunn studies about that writing can really help with mental health and aging.
Yes, there's actually quite a few things that you know, that are associated with, for example, group therapy is associated in people with cancer is associated with longevity from cancer. So there's a lot of things that are emotionally balancing or emotionally balancing, many different types of things and types of activities that are associated with longevity.
Now, what do you mean longevity from cancer?
Well, surviving.
Survive. Yeah. And what is it
cancer
that helps
survival.
Contribute to that?
Group therapy.
Group therapy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. That was one study that was done. So it's fascinating to see the correlation and the connection between the mind and the body.
Yeah.
Well, so
know,
we'll be talking about that on Sunday
When you have
night.
Something as serious as cancer, you tend to think you're the only one. I mean, why is this happening to me and I'm the only one and what do I do? You know,
exactly.
You're just lost.
It's very comforting and soothing to have other people that understand.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. What drew you to the field of mental health and Ayurveda?
Well, when I was a medical student, I went through various rotations, such as surgery and family medicine and things like that. And when I got to the area of psychiatry, I was immediately drawn, one, because I just love people. So I like to sit and talk to people, and they told me I'd get paid for that. And I thought, this is the field for me. And also I realized that that Transcendental Meditation, which is the sort of the cornerstone treatment of Maharishi Ayurveda, which I was practicing at that time, and there was research coming out at that time showing that a mental technique could not only help people with mental illnesses, but also could help healthy people become even happier, just normal healthy people, as well as helping people with medical problems. So I thought, well, this is a mental technique, Transcendental Meditation, and psychiatry is a field of the mind, and yet it's absent, this whole knowledge of how to meditate, how to transcend, how to experience deeper levels of oneself was absent from the whole field of mental health. And still is to a large extent. So that prompt, over the years, I've had increasing inspiration to write a book on what's missing in the field of mental health today.
Now, I have to wonder sometimes, you know, meditators may think that by meditating, that's going to solve everything, going to cure everything, and yet we still have mental health issues in this community.
Right.
How do you, you know...
Well, one of the things I do believe that the Transcendental Meditation and the various supportive aspects of Maharishi Ayurveda are very helpful to mental health. I mean, there's numerous studies showing that, for example, with insurance companies, that people that are practicing Transcendental Meditation have significantly better mental health and physical health because they utilize inpatient and outpatient services much less than the average person. These are a number of published studies. So it's a good thing, and it's helpful. And I think also it's not the only thing, but it's very the thing that I'm looking at is that the vast majority of people in the world, I mean, really don't know anything about how to meditate and the value of settling down and just experiencing quietness. And that's really who we are. And what I think what's missing in the field of mental health today is that it's addressing, like, for example, who are we? That really is the question I'm raising in this book. Who are we really? Are we our biochemistry? Are we our brain? Am I my brain? Or am I my thoughts or my feelings? And I think most people know, wait, there's a deeper part of me, who I really am. And that part is a part that's a non-active part of who we are. Because most people aren't aware of it because we're so active all the time. You know, we're right. Thinking, we're doing. Mm. And yet if we learn through the techniques in Maharishi Ayurveda, especially transcendental meditation, how to calm the mind to its most settled state, then that silent part of us, non-active part of us, is also a place which is very joyful, it's very blissful part of ourselves, and it's a very calm, peaceful part of ourselves. And that whole area is that whole part of ourselves isn't addressed by modern mental health. You know, what they address is the biochemistry, that therapy works on the our thoughts and emotions, but no one is really addressing the self, the whole person, who we really are. And it's kind of like, well, if you're missing the essence of who we are, how effective are the treatments going to be? And in fact, 1/3 of the population of the United States at any given time has a diagnosable mental illness. That's over 100 million people.
1/3?
Yes.
Really?
So that's 40 million people with anxiety disorders.
1 out of 3. Well, Mom, I know you and I are healthy, so.
You're on the other 2/3, you lucky guys. But it's quite staggering, the statistics. I mean, 25 million people have substance abuse, alcohol or substance abuse disorders. Yeah. 40 million have anxiety disorders, including post-traumatic stress disorder. And 16 million have depression.
Yeah.
So, and we're talking about all these medicines that are being used, and no one's addressing the natural, you know, very few people are really addressing the natural approaches that actually scientific research shows are very powerful in terms of balancing the mind and emotions.
And there's still this stigma surrounding mental health, too.
Yeah. There is such a stigma.
Yeah.
And I think the stigma is because, and in actuality, mental illness is no different than physical illness in terms of, you know, if you study what's going on, the brain has some imbalanced chemistry. Just like in high blood pressure, diabetes, whatever, there's an imbalance there. And yet what happens if your brain is imbalanced, you get judged harshly, really, by mm-hmm. others. And the reason is because it affects our behavior. So, you know, when the heart is imbalanced, you know, you might have a heart attack or something. No one's going to judge you. But when you have a brain imbalance, then people are going to see you acting maybe strange or depressed or whatever. And you kind of aren't the life of the party. You know, you're kind of a bummer, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So it affects. But really, in actuality, it's just an imbalance like any other condition. So in my mind, we should, as a society, be even more sympathetic and compassionate toward people with mental illness because they can't help it any more than a person with any other condition.
That's right. But why is it that people think you can help it?
I don't know. I mean, it's like what Trump said in that talk when he was talking to veterans and saying, well, you're the strong ones. You know, the weak ones have PTSD.
Right. Right. You that's yeah. Ignorance, I hate to say it. You know, I support our new president because that's what a good thing to do. But I think that's an ignorant statement.
But I think, you know, the reason is that we have a tendency to think that way is because maybe it's because we don't want to think that it can happen
exactly
to us.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, and many people actually, for example, military people, when they get depressed and they have suicidal thoughts, they don't tell anyone. Because if they tell anyone, they'll lose their job in the military.
Mm-hmm.
And they're afraid, so they don't. And then they end up killing themselves. One person every day in the United States from the military kills themselves. Every day. That's the statistic now. And a lot of it's because of the stigma. People are afraid to ask for help.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, because if it really is something that's beyond our control, then it's something to be afraid of.
Exactly. And it can happen to anyone and many people in their, if not themselves, at one time or other in their lives, but maybe a family member.
Yeah.
And it's uncomfortable, you know, being around somebody who might be, you know, suffering from a mental illness. And yet there's wonderful treatments available. And I'm just, with this book, I'm bringing in this whole field of natural medicine from India that's been, I would say, refreshed and re-enlivened by Maharishi for our modern era. But basically, it's just the knowledge of that there's a whole part of us that's not being acknowledged and not being accessed for the benefit of the mental health of the population.
Well, Jim, we just have a couple minutes left. Can you read a little
bit like
from the book?
I wanted to read a section from a part of a book. It's actually in the third essay, and this book has four essays, and it's The Origins of Mental and Emotional Imbalance. What causes mental illness from this system, from the point of view of this system? The great Ayurvedic physician Maharishi Charaka states in the Charaka Samhita that the main cause of disease is pragya parad, the mistake of the intellect. Pragya parad means that the intellect is caught up in the ever-changing boundaries and forgets about the self, the underlying unbounded reality that is the inner source of intelligence, creativity, peace, and joy. It causes us to identify ourselves in terms of boundaries, to believe that we are time-space-bound beings, when the truth is that although we are indeed operating in time and space, our deepest and truest nature lies beyond the field of boundaries. When pragya parada is eliminated and we experience our identity as the self, the result is self-esteem, happiness, stability, and inner peace.
Well, thank you, Dr. Brooks. That was Dr. Brooks reading from Reflections on Maharishi Ayurveda and Mental Health. And you'll be speaking at Dolby Hall this Sunday, November 13th.
Yep.
At 2 p.m.
8 p.m.
8 p.m. And the title of the presentation,
Mind
again?
Over Aging. And then afterwards, I'll be doing a book signing because it's
wonderful.
By the bookstore.
Oh.
So it's very conveniently located.
Well, thank you for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
All right.
Lots of fun.
Yeah.
Okay.
And we look forward to speaking with you again.
Oh, thanks.
One last question. Is this your first book?
This is my second book.
Your second book. And
actually,
what was the
title? It's actually my third book.
Okay.
But, the one book was a poetry book, which was really fun, really cool. So I'd never written poetry before I went to India. And then I went there, I got so inspired. I wrote a book of poetry. But the other book on Ayurveda is called Ayurvedic Secrets to Longevity and Total Health. That was written in published in 1995. With Prentice Hall Publishers.
And so this is published by MUM
Press? MUM Press, yeah.
All right. Well, congratulations on your new book, and look forward to hearing more from you.
Thank you so much for having
me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. And now we are being joined by Linda Agnes. And Linda has been with us before, but it's been a while.
Yes,
it has.
It's
been quite a number of years. I think we interviewed you about the... The Amish, what was the title of that book?
What was the title of that book?
Tales from the Amish or something?
No, it was...
Visits
with the Amish, visits. Impressions of the Plain Life.
And then I think we did one other of your books, too.
Yeah, maybe Super Healthy Kids.
Being
Our Own Heroes, I think. We talked because, remember, I was teaching that class of 80-year-old students
and then they came on. Yeah,
and that was a wonderful experience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I edited that volume.
Wow, that's right. And now we have a new book.
That's right.
And it's called The Ramayana, a new retelling of
Valmiki's
ancient epic, complete and comprehensive. And it is co-written with
Kumita Reddy.
Who you also did the Healthy Kids book.
Yes,
with,
I did three Ayurveda books with
Her. Ayurveda books. And Linda is the author of more than 500 articles and 5 books about the benefits of meditation, yoga, and healthy living. And we just talked about the 3 books she co-authored with Kumita Reddy. And She is an adjunct associate professor of writing at MUM, where she lives in Fairfield with her husband, Sanskrit scholar and author Thomas Egnos. And so tell us a little bit about this book, Linda.
Well, first of all, I guess it's kind of interesting to explain it. It's a retelling of an ancient epic from India. And the Ramayana is considered to be the oldest epic poem on earth. And it's also one of the longest at 24,000 verses in perfect meter. And but the difference between this epic and, say, the Odyssey or the Iliad is that it's not a dusty old tome. It's beloved by millions of people. In fact, 1 billion people in India alone use it as a spiritual guide and a daily spiritual guide. So it's really embedded in the culture, and also in Thailand, Nepal, Sri Lanka, and Bali, and in Cambodia, and many places in the Southeast. So its influence has spread. It's very much part of the culture there, and very much a living guide. And now its influence is spreading to the West. And it's actually has many, many lessons of that are relevant to us today.
So would it be considered the equivalent of the Bible for Hindus?
Well, this is a really good question. And actually, I can sum it up by saying it's actually a love story. It's an adventure quest. It's a hero's journey. And it is a spiritual volume. So the person who wrote the introduction was Michael Sternfeld from Fairfield, who's a Ramayana scholar and producer. And he has this great quote, which he says, that it's been called the Bible, Star Wars, and Romeo and Juliet all rolled into one. So that kind of gives you, it has something for everyone.
And most of the people who are familiar with it would be Hindu. Or is it?
Well, at this point, yes. Yeah. Although people in Thailand, for instance, are not Hindu.
Okay.
They're Buddhists, but they have the tradition of the Ramayana, and they enact it, and they have it. Like if you go to the Emerald Buddha, the Temple of the Emerald Buddha in Bangkok, there's these massive murals that have been painted hundreds of years ago, and that are intact and that depict the whole Ramayana. It's very much part of their culture.
Mm.
And it's a universal story. It has universal themes, themes of right action, what we would call dharma. And it's themes of compassion, forgiveness, love, of rulership through kindness and tolerance, and of how to treat a friend, a foe, an enemy, to turn your enemies into your friends. It has some amazing, beautiful lessons for us today.
When was it first written?
Well, Western scholars say about 2,500 years ago, but Indian scholars and the tradition itself places it way, way back, much, much further to the beginning of time or something. And well, the reign of Ram actually was probably not the beginning of time, but still back before recorded history. And it was passed down as an oral tradition first and then written. And this is what we call retelling. It's not a translation. It's not word for word. If it were a translation, it would be three volumes, huge volumes, if it were straight from the Sanskrit to the English. But this is condensed, but it maintains, our idea anyway, was to maintain the spiritual wisdom and the sweetness of the original and the depth, but to make it easy to learn and, in fact, to read and, in fact, to make it kind of a page-turner.
That must have been difficult, though, to be able to do that. From that massive volume.
Well, I can just give you one clue. We started it 19 years ago.
Wow. Okay, that tells me. That tells me. Okay, gotcha.
Wow.
So it was a complete journey of joy and transformation in a very positive sense, because we're dealing with these enlightened characters, Rama and Sita, who, even though they're pressed to their limits, as in any hero's journey, they have to, complications must ensue. Mm-hmm. And even though they're pressed to their extremes and the stakes rise higher and higher and they face bigger and bigger obstacles, they treat everyone they meet with compassion, kindness, tolerance, love, forgiveness. And it's just such an exhilarating, beautiful story.
Now, did you start with the Sanskrit? or were you starting with a translation?
Well, this is a really good question. I am not a Sanskrit scholar. I can't pull that one out of my pocket. My husband is a Sanskrit scholar, and so, of course, he helped us. But we worked with the, and Skumana is also not a Sanskrit scholar. So we worked with the English translations. So we worked with these huge three-volume ones. In particular, we worked with Shastri, Raghunathan, and the Gita Press version, and then some others that we looked into too. But whenever we came to kind of a disagreement between the different texts we were using, the translations we were using, then of course my husband could go straight to the Sanskrit words and give us insight. And also he helped tremendously with bringing this to fruition, because we took about a year and a half to write the first draft, but then it was supposed to be published by a small press, but then that kind of fell through, and so then we had no publisher, and that's one of the reasons it languished. But my husband kept saying, no, this is something that is really good. This will help, you know, this is something that will go far. And so he helped by putting all these Sanskrit, the direct translations of Sanskrit verses at the end of every chapter with the beautiful Devanagari script. And that added a really nice element. He helped with much of the editing and just was a really big champion of it. And as it turns out, he also helped us find our publisher, because he and Vernon, Tom and Agnes and Vernon Katz had done a translation that was a real translation. They are Sanskrit scholars of the Upanishads, much shorter volume of some of the principal Upanishads. And they found a fabulous publisher, Tartar Perigee, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. And so when that happened, we were about to self-publish this Ramayana. We actually had hired Shepley Hansen, my good friend, to do the cover and design, and he had already kind of started. But then when Tom got this contract, we're like, wow, well, this publisher could do our book too. And so we wrote to him. It took a year before he looked at it. But then within, I finally, Jack Forum, my friend, writer friend, he said, you know, year's long enough. Maybe I'll show it to Hay House, my editor at Hay House. And so, he said, you should nudge him. So I did. And he said, send it around. I don't want to stop you, but I will read it. And within a week, he had read it, emailed me some questions, and accepted it for publication. So it really happened fast.
Whoa.
When it happened. And that was just last December that we signed the contract.
So, now, at that point, did he edit it from there too?
Yes.
And so
yes.
You made...
Although, because we had already hired a professional editor, Kumana had hired Susan Shatkin, who is a fabulous editor, to do it. And so she had already hired her. And so we already had it edited. So the editor, it was really pretty ready to go. Mm-hmm. And so the editor just said, we don't want any major changes.
Uh-huh,
we just want
to
copy edit. So that was really good
yes,
news.
Yes, indeed.
Well, Linda, why don't you read a little bit so we can get a flavor of the book?
Certainly. I'm going to read from the prologue, and this just gives you a flavor of this enlightened character, this enlightened central figure in the Ramayana, Rama. Rama has controlled his mind. Radiant, powerful, and resolute, wise, eloquent, and glorious, he can easily destroy his enemies. With broad shoulders, a neck like a conch, and a prominent chin, he has long arms reaching to his knees. The personification of integrity, he helps those who seek him out. Ever mindful of the good in others, he is generous and keeps his word. Pure and devoted to truth, he is adept at attaining samadhi, transcendental bliss. With a pleasing disposition, Rama inspires virtue in others. With a perfect memory, he knows the essential nature of the Veda, or the sacred text. As rivers flow to the ocean, so the virtuous are devoted to Ram. Ram is delightful to gaze upon like the full moon, mighty like the ocean, firmly established in silence like the Himalaya. Like the earth, he is patient and devoted to the welfare of all.
Now, you mentioned that the Ramayana was written in perfect meter verse. Are the translations also in verse and in the same meter, or not?
I would say no. They're mostly in prose.
Okay.
And although my husband tells me that, I forget which Sanskrit scholar it is who is working, has been working on it for about 25 years, and he's working on doing it in perfect meter in English. It couldn't be the same Anish Tube meter that is, you know, intrinsic to the Sanskrit text, but still, to do it in perfect meter in English would be quite a feat.
Whoa.
And but our book does have it's been called lyrical, and it has poetry in it too. That we wanted to capture some of the feeling of the original poetry.
Now, of the people who you say this, the Ramayana is really part of their daily life, do they read it in Sanskrit, or
they read it mainly in their own languages? So it's been translated and retold in many different languages, most famously by Tulasidas, a 14th century saint in India, and he translated it into Hindi. And that is very dear to many people's hearts in India, and it's very much part of the culture. He kind of, he had a little bit of his own vision. He was filled with bliss and joy at doing this, and it just flowed into the pages.
Well, we don't have much time left, but tell us about your talk at MUM. When is that, and what will you be sharing?
Yes, on Monday night, I'll be speaking about Dharmic Dilemmas of the Ramayana and what we can learn from them. And that will be at 8 o'clock in Dalby Hall. And that's Monday, November 14th, 8 o'clock, Dalby Hall.
2016. In case you know, sometimes we rebroadcast shows or people listen to it online later because we put them up on writersvoices.com. And yes, we don't want people going out there looking for you on November 16th.
And like Jim Brooks, I will be doing a book signing afterwards. So you can buy the book there and have it signed.
This has obviously been a work of love for you.
Yes, a labor of love.
A labor of love.
For sure.
Do you feel differently about this than your other books?
I would say that this book was the most dear to my heart, and I'm sure Kumita felt the same way. So it was interesting that it took the longest to get published, but it found this fabulous publisher and is having a very wide distribution. So in that way, it's very fitting.
Oh, I bet. Mm-hmm. I bet. Well, that's wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us today on Writers' Voices.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you, Monica.
It's a pleasure.
I'd actually like to have you come back and talk more at length about the book.
I would love that.
I think that would be really
wonderful. Yeah, because
wonderful.
There's a lot in there that needs to be told.
Well, we're about out of time. We had a very busy show today.
We did. We had some wonderful guests and their books. It was really
great. And
they're
all in the studio with us, which is unusual because normally we're doing things over the phone. So it was really lovely to actually be able to see the people we're talking to.
Yes, thank you for having me. I appreciate
it. Thank you. And reminding people again, Monday evening at Dalby Hall, November 16th for Linda's talk at 8 p.m. And Mom, do you have some parting words for us today?
Yes, I do. I think it fits everybody that was here. The good in the game of life is to develop your talents and skills and then give them back to the world.
Mm-hmm. Stay tuned now for Planet Earth's Wild, which I believe is starting out with a tribute to Leonard Cohen, who just passed away and who is like my all-time favorite songwriter. And check out writersvoices.com. If you missed the show, we'll have it up eventually. Sometimes it takes me a little while, but also if you missed this in parts of it and want to hear it, if you're listening on Friday, or tell your friends, we rebroadcast Monday morning at 8 a.m. See you next week on Writers' Voices. Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU LP